Hi, everybody. Before we get to our next episode, I wanted to ask you to consider leaving a tip at my website, wordballoon.com, and joining what I'm calling the League of Word Balloon Listeners. Word Balloon is like no other comics podcast out there. Think about it. The average comic book takes 20 minutes to read, but here at Word Balloon, we give you 2 to 3 hours every week, bringing you conversations with the top creative minds in pop culture entertainment. Now we're in our 8th year of Word Balloon, and being a broadcast guy, I've avoided doing a pay subscription model for the show. But the reality is, there are production costs, whether it's updating equipment, traveling to conventions for more guest interviews and panels, or frankly, earning something for the effort of producing 10 to 12 hours of show content every month. I know it's a tough economy. That's why I'm happy to keep the show a free product as long as possible. But if you can swing a couple of dollars, do me a favor. Go to the front page of wordballoon.com, hit the donate button, and give what you can. If you gave last year, thanks. It's a new year, and these costs do keep going on. Check out the front page of Word Balloon. You'll see the contribution drop box there. As always, thanks for your support. And now, on with the show. Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress, and man, we got a great show for you today. It's my pleasure to be talking to the legendary animated director, Ralph Bakshi. Ralph has a Kickstarter campaign that he is starting today for his new animated film, Last Days of Coney Island. Why the move to Kickstarter instead of a major film company or cable company to release his new animation work? He also gives us updates on some proposed sequels for some Bakshi classics. Did you like Wizards? Did you like Fire and Ice? Bakshi's got you covered with great information and updates on all those possible sequels. Ralph explains in detail on a great conversation on Word Balloon. Then we talk to our pal Rick Remender. Rick is taking Marvel Now books in new directions. Captain America and Uncanny Avengers are going in great directions. The results are sometimes polarizing with fans. But as always, Rick likes to stretch the envelope, and I think it's great and representative of what he's doing in both of those books. It seems lately that Rick's success in the Marvel Universe is spilling onto his creator-owned work as well. Things like the Fear Agent Omnibus are going into second and third printings because of the unexpected demand for those things. We talk about all that and some new projects in the work for Rick on the second part of Word Balloon. Today, it's all brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. As always, you can get your favorite hardcovers, trade paperbacks, absolute editions, omnibus editions, essentials at great savings off the standard retail price at InStockTrades.com. Just a few examples. How about Creepy Archives Volume 15 from Dark Horse? 42% off. It's just $28.99. You can get Dark Avengers from our pal Jeff Parker. The End is the Beginning. 50% off. $9.99. Reach back and enjoy Global Frequency from Warren Ellis and a bunch of great artists. 50% off for the trade paperback, $9.99. From Dark Horse, Star Wars Omnibus, The Infinites. Those are the story arcs of episodes 4 through 6, and they're kind of what-if versions. Really interesting takes on different paths for those familiar Star Wars stories. 42% off, $14.49. You can also get from DC Justice League Hardcover Volume 2, The Villain's Journey, at 50% off, $12.49. Don't take my word for it. Don't take my word for it. Check it out for yourself. Head to InStockTrades.com and start saving on your books right now. Okay, gotta be honest, I am a gushing fanboy for our first guest, the legendary rebel filmmaker, Ralph Bakshi. You might recognize the name. He started his career at Terrytoons in the 1950s, working on things like Mighty Mouse, Heckle and Jekyll, and Deputy Dog. In the 60s, Bakshi took over the reign on the classic Spider-Man cartoon. And starting in the 70s through the 90s, he had a string of exciting and diverse animation that said something. From controversial films like Coonskin and Heavy Traffic to his adaptation of Robert Crumb's Fritz the Cat, fantasy works like Wizards, which celebrated its 35th anniversary last year, to his adaptation of The Lord of the Rings, Fire and Ice from 1983, co-directed by Bakshi's friend Frank Frazetta and written by comic book legends Jerry Conway and Roy Thomas, to rock and roll imagery in American Pop and Cool World, which starred a young Brad Pitt, Gabriel Byrne, and Kim Basinger. In 1997, Bakshi developed Spicy City, the sci-fi HBO cartoon series. Today, like many artists unwilling to compromise their visions, Bakshi is launching a Kickstarter campaign for his latest animation project, Last Days of Coney Island. As a longtime admirer of Mr. Bakshi's work, it's my pleasure to start this episode of Word Balloon with Ralph Bakshi. I'm a longtime fan, sir, and it's a pleasure to speak to you, and I thank you for doing this interview.
No problem.
I'm psyched for the new movie. I'm thrilled that you're doing this, and I'm intrigued that you're using Kickstarter to fund Last Days of Coney Island. What can you tell me? Why the crowdfunding through Kickstarter?
Well, it's an easy question to answer. First of all, I'm not looking to do anything except animation. And I'm looking, I don't have any dreams of, huge merchandising schemes or major releases from theaters anymore. In other words, I decided, I've always enjoyed to do the films that I wanted to do. And I decided I'm going to try to make movies and release them on the net, meaning my blog or the Backstreet Channel, which we're creating, or on YouTube, that if I could raise money to do this, that I could be creatively free, and it would be good for animation, plus there'd be no restrictions, just like your blog here, and there would be no fighting with studios who tear up my films and rip them to shreds. I did take Last Days a couple of years ago, Coney Island, to studios, and they said it wasn't merchandisable. Well, of course it wasn't. No, it's not.
Sure.
But I said, look, I don't need a lot of money. I'm not looking to merchandise it. I'm looking to do a good movie, and I don't mind if millions of people come to a theater and make you guys rich. And I don't mind driving an old Ferrari around. I have nothing against money if it comes the right way. I just don't want to exactly do what you're doing, which is, kind of merchandisable stuff only. So I took it back home, and then I realized after watching the Kickstarter thing that this might be a way, and I'm trying to prove it if it is a way. And then I'll be doing all my animation for the net, and maybe somehow I'll find a way to make a profit so I can make it myself without going to Kickstarter. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Well, I understand, and I can appreciate that. It really does blow my mind, given your body of work and the media outlets that are there, that some HBO or Showtime, I understand maybe from a major film company's perspective, and as you say, they're looking for merchandising, but it just seems like you've always had this great edgy voice that, people respond to when they see your movies, but it shocks me that there were no TV outlets that might be interested in being in the Ralph Bakshi business.
Well, you brought up an interesting question. I didn't even think about it. Nobody calls anybody. Everyone everyone waits for some poor filmmaker to come through the door so they could take as much as they could from him, because if they call a filmmaker, then the negotiations are on the filmmaker's side. I guess. I'm not sure. What I'm saying is, HBO and Showtime in any one of those places could have had this. They still might. In other words, once they see it and I make it, if I'm lucky enough to get the money, that doesn't mean that they won't call. Or I could send them the film and say, here it is. It'll be easier for me to do it. In other words, what's great about this, because I did an HBO animated series called Spicy City. Well, if you think they didn't interfere, if you think they live up to everything they say, they're all over you. What they plan is a certain outrageousness, but it's all planned. It's all very much like, we're cool, except we're going to figure out how to be cool. We just can't be. So what I'm saying is, as long as you have executives running around, you don't know what the fuck is going to come out of their mouth at any given point. So if I do this and they like what they're looking at, I'd love to do a longer version on HBO. I wasn't even considering it, but Spicy City. Let me tell you a story on Spicy City. Okay, little Rocky. So I sell Spicy City to HBO, and I sell it with me wanting to hire unknown writers from New York, because I was living in New York at the time, okay?
Okay.
And I wanted to hire different nationalities, Chinese and Korean. I wanted to get another perspective. Because I got so tired of my own perspective and of Hollywood's perspective, Hollywood writers, you know.
And sure.
And I hired a bunch of five writers, you know. One was a one had just gotten out of prison, you know, and it was clean, but he, you know, Puerto Rican kid, and they all were raw and intelligent, and they wrote poetry also, and they went to poetry, those slam bang poetry things in Manhattan. They were great, great guys, and I was paying them $1,500 a script. They were crying. I mean, these guys never made more than $100 a night and never wrote.
Sure.
And we had a hit show. We had the highest rating in our time slot, okay, the first season. Then HBO gives me a call. It's on the second season. And they say, this is a true story. The guy that did that is gone. Since he ran HBO at that point, they threw him out. Chris Albrecht.
Okay.
That was his name. He happens to be Chris Albrecht. He's in charge of the whole thing. And he says, you know, we want to use L.A. writers. I go, what? He says, we want to use L.A. writers. I say, wait a minute. These guys just gave you a hit show. They're great. Why do you, L.A. writers, what are they going to do? Why would I need them? And what do I tell these guys? That thanks for the hit show, goodbye?
You know, wow.
So I quit. And that's why Spicy didn't even off the air.
I see.
I walk out. Man. What I'm saying is, why? You know why they wanted L.A. writers? Because they had a hit show, and now they wanted to control it. They wanted to make sure it was taken out of my hands. In other words, with my writers, I controlled the show. With their writers, if they're going to hire those writers, they control the writers. So they had a hit show, and they wanted to continue. They wanted to take it over. And that was that. You know, most directors in my position would have gone with them because there's a lot of money involved, potentially. But I didn't. There's no way I can go to those guys and say, guess what, guys? Thanks. But, you know, to get them to write and to get their hopes up, you know, one of the things about working with artists is, like, you know, you want them to feel great. You want them. The better they feel, the better the work is.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? So I was furious. I don't know. More angry in my whole life. You know, it's one thing to blow something and they say, look, we changed their writers. But there's another thing, you have the best rating that ever had in that time slot and want to change the writers that got you there. How sick is that? They wouldn't have made it because the only reason the show existed was because of its edginess. You know, it's like how homosexuals writing. You know, what you do with the homosexual, the Philippine guy, a guy out of jail, a Puerto Rican. I mean, yeah, that guy wrote The Hand, the hand that was cut off a guy and was running around killing people. I mean, they had a whole other look on what American horror is. They got some different origins. I thought that in itself was a brilliant idea. So when you say HBO in these places, why go to Kickstarter? I don't know. You know, I've had two experiences with them. They'll look at Last Days. I'd love for them to do it if they want to do what I just did. If I manage to make it on Kickstarter, if they want to do what I'm doing on Kickstarter, fine. Here, what I'm doing on Kickstarter is the pilot, in a sense. You know, so that's the pilot for it. And the second short that I would do for Kickstarter is Wizards 2. There was a sequence cut out of Wizards 1, you know, that I've always wanted to. We didn't have the money to finish. I made the picture and I had to let it go. But it wasn't exactly part of the story. I couldn't afford the extra length. You know what I'm saying? So it was a very heavy scene. It was this railroad, this boxcar that was taking the elves. You know, there's all about Nazis with it. So
right.
Taking the elves locked up to a concentration camp. So, you know, which has happened to the Jews in World War II. And I certainly was discussing that with it. And all these elves were in boxcars, and on top of the boxcars, you know, were those green soldiers, the Nazis, the Black Wolf soldiers. And peace attacks the boxcar to free the elves. And it's an incredible action sequence of them killing all those bastards. You know, the train roars along over precipices and stuff and over bridges, you know. And it's a violent scene. And, of course, he manages to stop the train and free the elves. So I want to do that sequence. So after Last Days, I would do that for Kickstarter.
That's fantastic. And I got to tell you, sir, Wizards was the first of your films that I saw. And it blew my mind. And that's really exciting to hear that a new sequence like that, you know, is something that you would want to fund it and do. I think that's fantastic. And it's interesting. Wouldn't it seem, and forgive me for armchair quarterbacking you, but wouldn't it seem like that might be the better one to start with, given the cult popularity of Wizards? I'm thrilled that you're doing something new. And I'm always excited when you have something new out there. So Last Days of Coney Island is exciting in itself. But it just seems like to get the ball rolling, maybe Wizards
I have my own shrewdness, sort of Brooklyn shrewdness. You know, I take a chance. Now, you're going to announce Wizards 2. And I, in the Kickstarter film, allude to it. I show Pete riding around. What I'm hoping is, you know, because I've done Wizards. You know, I'm not great on sequels, but I'd like to do this for the fans, you know.
So okay.
I've done Wizards. I love Teeth. But for me to stay fresh, I've got to see what I got left on new characters. So, okay. Motherfucker, if you want to see Wizards 2, get Last Days going, you see. So in a way, I'm saying, look, guys, this is for me, Last Days. Wizards is for you. You know what I'm saying? So
I do.
That's what I'm doing. Number three, I would do Coonskin too.
Fantastic.
So that's the announcement. I mean, that's my plan, and that's what I'm trying to do. And then Heavy Traffic. And what I'm saying is I could continue to do more with each one of these films and release them on the net. So maybe I could start a business on the net. Maybe just making them is enough. You know, I'm 74. Just making them and working with a bunch of talent, small. You know, whatever you want to do, do you know what you know how great that is? I mean, do you know how amazing that I get $50 or $100 to direct a film. I make a small salary. Could you imagine the joy in working with talented people on whatever we want? I don't know what drives these other guys, you know, these other artists and animators. You know, I have no idea why you'd sit there doing the same stuff over and over and over again just for a big salary. If I could do this, I'd be the happiest man in the world. Certainly, it would be nice to go out and do a $1 billion grossing film. If it's the film I want, I got nothing against paying my animated fortunes, and I've got nothing against buying an old Ferrari or something and driving around America in it. You know, but I won't sell out to get it, I think is the difference. But could you imagine just as an artist, and that's all I am? So it's a win-win-win-win situation. But you could tell those people they want to see Wizards, they better get Last Days funded.
I understand. Yeah.
I'm in Brooklyn. I'm Brooklyn, and, you know, I'm being, anyway, that's great. So that's what I'm doing.
Well, I think that's great, and it's really fantastic to see that you get what the opportunity to make this stuff for the internet is. And it seems like it's great to hear that from someone like yourself that, you know, has had big time films and stuff. And you get the like you say, I mean, you stay true to your vision and you can make it the satisfaction of the artist at this point of making this new stuff. No, I think that's wonderful.
I've always said as an artist, because that's how I made these films, because I wasn't going to, you know, it always was that for me. I could sell films today if I sell out. I mean, Pixar's offered me, you know, to direct some of their movies. Really, are you crazy? I said, what I'm saying is, no, that's what I'm talking about, you know, the joy of being an animator. But let me tell you something off the record, okay?
Okay, all right. We won't put this on, by all means.
Okay, but you can. You think about it. Yeah, you could put it on. Look, let me tell you something, okay? The older you get, I don't want to get too morbid, but, you know, the older you get, the more you realize it's a one-way ticket in this life we lead. It's a one-way ticket. We're not getting out of this alive. We're just not. And it doesn't matter how much we die with it financially. You better do something you really love on the way, or the whole thing's been a waste of time. We're all going down the same roads. You know, sooner or later, and the way the world looks, it may even be sooner. That's all it's about.
I hear you.
Guys, I can't make these decisions thinking they're going to somehow not face this issue, they're going to live forever and can sell out their whole lives and be miserable, but make a lot of money. You know, okay, if that's what you want to do, but does it make you happy? We've got one way on this road. It's a one-way road. Now, that's the best advice I can give to everyone, anyone listening out there. Think about that. You can't hide from the truth. Everyone hides from the truth. This is the real reality. We're out of here. We're gone. It's finished.
I'm with you. Now, I'm back to Last Days of Coney Island.
Yeah.
As you say, this is kind of a pilot episode.
Yeah.
So are you thinking – and this is before the Kickstarter is out, so you might address this in the video. But I'm going to ask you, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, how long do you think it'll –
That's how much money we get.
I see.
That's how much bread we get. You know, if we get enough money, I'll do the whole fucking thing for an hour. You know, it depends
Great.
On what comes in, so it's hard for me to say.
Is your background, when you first got into animation, this was, you know, the 50s and Terry Toons. Are there tricks that you learned as far as maybe, and forgive me, because I saw lots of this stuff on television, and I can't remember how much of it was produced for the theaters and how much of it was produced for television. But I know you also did your body of work in limited animation back in the 60s as well. Are those tricks... And ability to do that kind of limited animation, do you apply any of that kind of
That's a very good question. Okay. Full animation is what I try to do and do, and I've always done. What Terry Toons taught me, you know, is production tricks. In other words, how the stuff goes through the house and how you finish it. I use every trick in the book imaginable, and there are millions of them. Most guys don't, to keep the cost down. For example, Wizards, okay, and Fritz. We could not afford pencil tests. You know what pencil tests are, right?
I do. Yes, sir.
We could not afford pencil tests. Okay. I won't have pencil tests. That's not a trick. That's a production decision. So
sure.
My animators are hired. Well, both the animators are hired, Virgil Ross, you know, all those great short animators, with 50 years experience in the business, I wasn't concerned. They've got so many pencil tests at this stage of their life to know they're good. And if the scene's not exactly perfect, I'll still put it in. That's a trick. I mean, if you're doing, I've seen guys go out of business trying to make that scene the most perfect scene in the world. And you know why they, till they cost them a fortune. And you know why they do it? But they're not saying anything. You see, if you're saying something, the animation could be a little crude, a little sloppy. If you're not saying anything, it better be good, because that's all you're looking at on the screen is good animation. If it's not good, you're not saying anything. Who needs you? So what I'm saying is they get terrified at putting anything on the screen that's not what they call perfect. No. I say, guys, let's all get to this. Let's all do the best we could. I want full animation. That's quality. But I'm not going to shoot you if you make a mistake. So, and the production tricks that I learned, I'll use every trick in the book to keep the cost down. And there are a million of them. So that's my technique.
Okay.
But it's also, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, finish your thought and then
I'm not
going to
kill an animator if he makes a mistake. And I put it up in the bed. Look, guy, that could have been better, but so what? You know, what's his name? Angie's beating the shit out of Ida. Who cares if the hit's not perfect? We know he's beating her up. You know, and that in itself is nuts. You know, so those are the kind of decisions I make as a director. If I was working for Disney, it would have to be perfect. But I'm not doing anything except the fairy dust, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, how about the tools today? Do you, do you ever try and draw on a tablet with a stylus?
Of course I have, and the film I put together on Kik, the computer and the programs and what you could do with the computer is mind-boggling. It allows, you know, everything I did on Traffic and Wizards and everything, I got in the box in my living room on my computer at 1/10 the cost. So the entire back-end production is now virtually nothing. This means I can pour more into the animation. I hire young animators. Colleen Cox is a girl who lives in Singapore for 2 years, self-taught animator. She did the first animation on the Kickstarter film of the new characters, right? She works, I think, dead ahead on the Wacom tablet. wonderful work. I have nothing against the new techniques. I draw, you know, on pencil and paper and things, and I scan it to these different various people.
Mm-hmm.
And they go to work with it on their computers. So I'm pretty much do it my way. But my animes and stuff, they're all on those programs. And that's what I want. But I'm not animating. So, you know, that's their job.
Understood.
You know,
understood.
But I love the computer. It's allowed me to do this. I don't have to leave my house, and I could do these shorts. If I left my house, my wife would shoot me. Because she doesn't want me to go back to work. You know, she says I go crazy. And I used to go crazy because it was so hard, and I was fighting all the time. But the computer has kept me alive and got me back into the business. So I have nothing to say except I am fucking amazed at what you can do on the computer.
Fantastic. That's great. What about writing? I always enjoy that you go back to the 60s on a lot of your stories. And this is another one, Last Days of Coney Island. What can you tell us about the story for the short?
Okay, I'll give you a brief. First of all, writers write what they know about. If they're writing about what they know about, the stuff is weak. If they're faking it, the stuff doesn't come off. And that's basically why I say when animators get together and do a picture, they're mainly lies. What does that mean? It means that you sit down and try to concoct stuff that wasn't necessarily part of your personal experience to make it exciting and interesting for people. So in a sense, you're concocting stuff. I go back to the 60s because I have a lot of experience in the 60s. You know, and there's a lot of stories to tell. And people were different then. I can make this comparison. The picture compares today in the 60s and what's going on today. You know, it compares the peace movements, last days. See, Coney Island used to be a glorious spot in America. But Coney Island now is all burnt down and dead. Very similar to what's happening to America, in other words. We're losing our way. I don't have to tell you about Congress. I don't want to go into talking about the mortgage finance mess and all the banks that rob people clean.
You bet.
And could you imagine not wanting to tax the rich? I mean, all this is new to America, you know. And if I go back in the 60s, I can talk about it. I could talk about Kennedy's assassination, which is happening in a bar, while my characters are talking about something else, and how they react to it. You know what I'm saying? Also determines,
yes, sir,
what the attitude was. So there's a lot going on. It's about, basically, Last Days of Coney Island is about an egotist who's about 4.5 feet high, you know, who thinks he's God, you know, which is like, and acts like we're acting now, you know, and it tells a story about what a lot of, it's a murder story, it's a horror story, but it all weaves through the 60s, Bobby Dylan's coming alive. You know, one of the bar scenes, when the kid, Kennedy's son, salutes him at a funeral procession. It was a stunning piece of film that happened when they were taking the funeral cortege, you know, after.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
You know, and Molly says, oh, isn't that cute? You know, looking at the television. And this little son of a bitch says, yeah, you want to see his father. You know, it's that kind of thing that allows me to get into the various things that I heard in the 60s, you know. So it discusses people trying to live their lives and how the outside world affects them or doesn't affect them, you know. So I write as I go, and I change as I go, and my style is very much that. So I've written the script. Whether that's the script I end up with, I couldn't tell you. I know I handed in heavy traffic. You know, I rewrote the thing, and I handed in Coonskin. And as I was making the picture, it totally changed. So I don't know how I work. It's very odd. You know what I'm saying? So I just don't want to give away the story either, because I don't want to get a sick version of it from the studio. You could say
understood.
That. You know, it's, you know, I got to be careful that someone doesn't jump on it and does a merchandisable I bet tonight will move you out of here.
I understand. Well, you're a great eavesdropper, it seems, because there's always these moments in your films that really are just seem like you're a fly on the wall. And before we talked today, I was watching a bit of Fritz the Cat, and that opening scene of the construction workers talking about how kids today, you know, they think they invented having sex before marriage, but the respect that we used to show to, you know, when we used to go out with a girl, it was just one girl. And it's just this wonderfully natural conversation between guys. And it really does sound like, you know, you just stuck a microphone amongst a bunch of construction workers.
But I did. That's part of my stuff. Look, you want construction workers talking. I wrote that down, right? Then you go, this is what you want in the film. You want to open up a film on a high bridge up there, you know, building a building, discussing the 60s. That's what I want as a writer-director, right? I went and found a bunch of construction workers. We sat down with a bottle. I bought a bottle. I bought my tape recorder. I gave each guy $100. And I'd ask them questions, just like you're asking me. And they would talk and talk. You know, and I edit the tape, and what I want, like it, and I, you know, the edited. You would see the stuff I had to throw out. It
sure.
It was so great. I could have made 5 movies out of it. But that is
that's
my
great.
Technique. But that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm going to do in Last Days. So what I'm saying is I did the same thing with the Black revolutionaries talking in the bar. You know, I was born in Oakland. You know, I remember I was so poor, my mother gave me peanut butter jelly sandwich. That was the same thing.
Wow.
These are moments that you just go to the real person. And that's what I mean about reality. Now, look, you know, Hunter Thompson does that. Kerouac did that. I'm part of that generation, you know.
Absolutely.
So, you know, jazz and musicians do that. So that's my background. That's my upbringing. You know, being on the streets. That's why I can't stand Disney, because they're not on the streets. I don't know where they are.
I hear you.
I don't know where they are. Yeah.
I like to show people that opening sequence of Hey Good Looking with the pile of trash talking about heaven. And then the you know, just the meaning of life, it seems. And it's I love that scene. And honestly, where did that come from? That was fantastic. And just the whole idea of these two piles of garbage talking about heaven and, you know, what it means.
I wrote that. I do write stuff too. No,
sure.
I'm always discussing God and heaven and misconceptions. There's misconceptions about religion. There's misconceptions about who we are. You know, someone else is, you know, here's a bunch of garbage going to get burnt, and they think they're going to heaven there. You know, I wrote that. I love to do that. You get a lot of that in Last Day. You get a lot of
that. That's excellent. Fantastic, man. The Spider-Man animated series,
yeah.
You know, everyone, decades later, we all still love it, and it really is such an important piece. And you know, I talk to a lot of comic book creators. That's my bread and butter as far as a lot of my interviews. Good memories of that experience? How do you look back on those episodes of Spider-Man?
It was fine. You know, I wasn't making Fritz the Cat yet.
Right.
Heavy Traffic wasn't even in my mind exactly, you know.
Okay.
I was due. I had a major character to work with in my own studio. I wanted my own studio very badly, you know, because I wanted to be able to make my own cartoons. Had pretty much full control. The budgets were horrible, you know, but I worked with great artists like Storenko and Gray Morrow. It's where I met Frazetta and I met Krinkle. So,
wow.
You know, Wally Wood did some work for me and did some work for me at Paramount. So I was feeling good. I was young. You know, I was about 25, 26. So, you know, when you're young, everything's fine. So I was very happy with it. You know, it's fine.
And you mentioned Fire and Ice, and I had no idea, but I was reading some other interviews you did last year, and somebody mentioned that Robert Rodriguez wanted to do a remake of Fire and Ice.
I spoke to him this week over email, and he said he's going to shoot it next summer.
Wow.
You bet your ass well, because I get a nice fee. I get a nice fee if he shoots it. He came
good.
And he wanted to do it. He wants to do it live action. I would never remake that film. So it's fine. You know, make it like
sure.
Sin City and Frazetta. And he said he wouldn't. He says, as an emailer, you can't believe all the emails. He said he's shooting again next summer. He's now shooting Sin City 2.
Right.
You know, so I see no reason to lie to me. That's his intention. And yes, he's, you know.
Wow, that's fantastic. And, you know, sir, I really enjoyed your participation in the Frazetta documentary, Playing with Fire, a few years ago, too. and it was fun seeing your friendship with Frazetta on camera.
I love the guy. I love the guy. He's gone, you know.
Yes, sir.
His kids are – never mind. He's gone. I feel terrible about that. Man, like, what's the world without Frank Frazetta? It doesn't make any sense. Anyhow, I love the guy. He was just great. He just was – this was a guy, you know. I also beat him a lot in stickball, so he doesn't never admitted it. He was fighting for me. You know. Now that he's dead, he can't argue, you see, but so whether I did it to that, it doesn't matter. I say I did.
Hey, honestly, I appreciate your time. I'll let you go, but good luck with the Kickstarter campaign. I hope that we'll have the opportunity to talk again.
Anytime you want. You're a good guy. You're a good guy. Where are you out of?
I'm in Chicago.
Ah, Chicago, no wonder. Great people, good people. Ah, wonderful Chicago people. Ah, Louise Zingarelli, one of the best artists ever worked for me. Louise Zingarelli worked for me on all kinds of movies. I was out of Chicago. She recently passed from cancer, but Chicago is cool. Thanks. Anytime you want to, could speak to me.
Okay, pretty obvious. Not too much journalistic edge on my gushing interview and talk with Ralph Bakshi. I can't help it. I know what you're asking. Why no talk about Lord of the Rings? Well, as you can tell from the tenor of the talk, Ralph is directed at making his own stories now and not interested in adapting anymore. So it just didn't seem right in our limited time to talk about Lord of the Rings. Maybe our next conversation, we might get into that. There's so much to talk about with this guy, and I really do hope it's not our only conversation that we have with Mr. Bakshi. Okay, on to another Word Balloon favorite, and I don't want to minimize his contributions to Word Balloon and, of course, the comic book world, our pal Rick Remender, whose work has always been a pleasure for all of us, whether it's his creator-owned works, man, going back to things like Sea of Red and Nightmare, to the wonderful space opera of Fear Agent, which is enjoying new success now in omnibus fashion. He's already on the third printing for the new Fear Agent omnibus from Dark Horse, which is just crazy and unexpected. But glad to see that his Marvel fans are picking up on his creator-owned work. Of course, right now, Rick is doing excellent work for Marvel in the Marvel Now world of Captain America, taking a fish out of water. What does it mean to be Captain America when you're in a world where Captain America and the U.S. has no meaning? It's an interesting idea, and that's what we're looking at with Rick's exploration of Captain America, plus his excellent work as well on Uncanny Avengers, starting with that heartfelt first issue, reflecting on the death of Charles Xavier, a touching eulogy from Wolverine, and you really get into the heads, I think, of the characters that Rick is assembling for this team. And, of course, new ideas and ways to make the Red Skull evil. Rick always finds new ways to play with these characters, and I think that's what makes him one of the special creators today. So let's have a conversation now with Rick Remender on Word Balloon. Welcome back to Word Balloon, Rick Remender. I'm sorry it's been so long.
Oh, you're not sorry yet, John, but you will be.
And we are off to the races. No, it's good, man. It's all good, and I'm really happy for you. I'm glad everything's going so well. The Marvel Now books are fantastic. And we were just talking before we started rolling tape that the Fear Agent omnibus sales are doing well, and that warms my heart as well. And that's what led me to first speaking to a Rick Remender back in the day.
Yeah.
So that's great that this is, you know, the system works. I mean, that was the hope that maybe doing the Marvel Now stuff would get Marvel readers excited to maybe try out things like Fear Agent.
Sure, yeah. I mean, of course, you know, and you know, there's a million reasons to make sure you give the Marvel work your all. And, you know, one of them is that it's a giant billboard with with characters that you grew up reading. You want to do your very, very best, but also when people enjoy what you've done, they'll travel backwards and hunt down your creator-owned stuff. And so we did the first printing of the Fear Agent hardcover, we did 3,000 copies thinking that it would take a year to sell out and that would be that. And those had sold out within a couple months before even shipping. They were all...
Yeah.
And so then we put the second print into production and set that at another 3,000. And I found out today that that's sold out, and it doesn't even ship till April.
Fantastic, man.
So we're going into the third printing already, and man, that was a 6-year long fight. So it sure is nice that people are starting to discover that book. So much great Tony Moore and Jerome Pena and Kieran Dwyer and Francesco Francovilla, and it's loaded with good artists. So it's nice that it's getting eyes.
Absolutely. Hilary Barta on a couple of the shorties, and Mike Hawthorne helping out in that last arc and all.
Mike Hawthorne, John Lucas, Hilary Barta.
Yes.
I mean, the list goes on. We just had a murderer's row of super talented fools on that thing. I mean, it was as far as, you know, the difficulty was is because we had so many great artists and because that was sort of the mandate that Tony and I set out from the get-go, is that the scheduling, you know, the shipping delays, I think, really hurt it in the floppy form. But
sure.
By fighting it out and doing it the way we wanted to, not sacrificing quality and building it with the guys we wanted to and taking the time that it needed to do it, I feel like now that it's all finished that way, it sure is nice because there's not one of those issues that was rushed to print or had, you know, three artists to get it done on time or any of that. It's all just the same, you know, five or six guys putting in the love.
Absolutely, man. Quality product, start to finish, and thrilled that the omnibuses are selling as well as they are. And what else is going on? I mean, I want to acknowledge because I saw the activity on Twitter, and I went to the links. Jack Davis is that a new print for Fear Agent? What is that?
No, we commissioned that as a variant when we went to Dark Horse.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
And. Tony actually hunted down Jack Davis and gave him a call and asked him if he would be able to do a commission, and Jack wanted to read the comic books first. And he responded to Tony by telling him he wished Harvey Kurtzman was alive because it was a beautiful book and he couldn't put it down. And boy, that was it. You know, like doing an EC homage and with how much that stuff inspires us. To get Jack Davis to say something like that and then to do that image, you know, there's just nothing else that can happen at this point. That's always going to probably, you know, always probably. That's always going to be the pinnacle of my career unless something magical happens, like Wally Wood comes back from the dead.
I understood, and I remember that moment. I talked to you and Tony about that, and it was thrilling. For some reason, I just remembered the solo image of Heath and not the alien with him. And I'm not sure why. I never got that variant. I only saw it online.
Right. I think it might have been – we did release the rough pencils when it was just Heath, I think. You might have seen that.
Okay, yeah, that might have been it. But, yeah, it's fantastic. So – and refresh my memory. I like I said, I saw the print now being available. Is Jack selling it? Who's selling it?
It's for the – we gave the artwork to the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund.
Fantastic.
And so they're selling prints. They're big, beautiful prints signed by Jack Davis for $30. I mean, the fact that they haven't already sold out just means that we haven't gotten word out. So I'm glad you brought it up. Anybody is interested, you can go to the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund website and order one while there's still some left, because I know that they're running out. But yeah, it's a gorgeous print. I've got one hanging up. I'm looking at it right now.
No, and truly one of the great causes in comic books, obviously, and I think that's fantastic. And absolutely, it's a beautiful print, and people should check it out. And it's a steal for $30, and you get Jack Davis's autograph in the process. That's wonderful.
I almost wanted to go off on a rant about, like, and if you kids don't know about Jack Davis, you don't know shit. Get it yourself down to a library and look at, you know, but the kids don't, you know, come on. The young people don't want to hear that from us, John. They don't want to hear us ranting about what they should know. But they should know Jack Davis. They should know.
It's absolutely true. No, his work beyond comics and stuff, he was a TV guide illustrator for years and, you know, pretty much did caricatures of everybody's favorite actors and comedians and celebrities back in the day. So many album covers as well.
Yep.
Of a lot of vintage people that nobody but you and I have heard of, like Spike Jones and people like that. But no, he really was one of those great great caricature artists of Mad. And in fact, and I think I've said this in a previous interview with you, my sports radio station commissioned him to do an ad. And that was really amazing. And they didn't end up using it. And our promotions guy still had the proof, and the you know rough art that he sent us for that. And he's like, "Do you know who this guy is?" And I'm like, "That's Jack Davis art. What the hell?" And he goes, "Yeah, he was going to do an ad for us, but his price was too high." And I'm like, "Jack Davis, for God's sake.
Oh,
what are you,
man.
Nuts?" I know, man. And he's like, "I remember him from Mad Magazine. I like this stuff."
Oh.
I'm like, "All right." Ah. Oh, well.
Shakes fist at sky, screams con.
But with all that in mind, let's move on to the Marvel Now stuff because, man, I'll tell you, both books are just tons of fun. I know you wrapped up Uncanny X-Men, and I want to talk about that in a future date because I've been slow. Because you know, honestly, the stuff I read was because of you, Rick. As you know, I'm not a big X-Men fan, and I had no idea who the hell Apocalypse was in that first arc, for example.
Right.
But all the stuff with Archangel and everything really was incredible, and I really want to finish it before I talk to you. So in the meantime, let us focus on the now with Uncanny Avengers and Captain America, and let's talk about Cap first because in a lot of ways it feels like Cap is kind of running in Heath Houston territory right now in a good way, and I love it. Honestly, I reached out to you and Ramita as well to talk to both of you, and I still intend to. Johnny will probably be on the next episode, but I love the look of the book. I love the idea of what is Captain America if the people he's fighting really don't understand the concept of what America is and what does that mean for Cap.
I think it's
terrific, man. Is that where you started? I mean, what was the what led you to this pitch and this idea for Cap?
Well, I was I wanted to find something that I could do to strip away Captain America and get down to the character. I think that I recognized I had reread piles and piles of, you know, Roger Stern and Jack Kirby and Ed Brubaker, and I just read so many of these stories, and there were so many great ones, but I never felt like I knew him, and I couldn't get my head around it. You know, I was like, well, he loves Sharon Carter, and he's in S.H.I.E.L.D., and there's Dum-Dum Duggins, but, you know, and he and Nick Fury used to razzle around, but I just couldn't understand him, and I realized it was because the 98-pound weakling who refused to not go who refused to be left behind and insisted that he was going to go fight the Nazis. You just take that for granted. We're always told that part of the story and just expected to know this guy was a weakling, but he had a big heart. But that doesn't mean anything to me, is what I recognized. Like, I don't know what that means. How did he get that heart? Because if he was born with it and it was just this thing that he was just gifted with from God, that's kind of boring. And so I started writing notes down about just subtle, quiet little scenes that could help form this person that would take place in the Lower East Side and during the Great Depression. And as I was writing that stuff, a couple of the initial ideas I had for the story were shot down and didn't go over so well. And so I was trying to think up what would be something that could juxtapose nicely. And I recognized by taking Cap out of his element and making him a fish out of water, that what I got out of that was the ability to juxtapose his hopelessness in a situation where he's a castaway in a dimension dominated by one of his greatest villains, and at the same time show how he earned the kind of tenacity and diligence and courage that it takes to survive this kind of an ordeal. And that led to Ian, and Ian's arc changed a few times. And I had a lot of conversations with Tom Brevoort and John Romita and Dean White, and I spend a lot of time on the phone talking, and Lee Lowridge, you know, like I've got a good crew of guys around me who I can springboard off of. And mm-hmm. I talked this thing through enough that I came up with some very exciting ideas for Ian and where he ends up in all of this, and Jet Black, Zola's daughter, and Zola himself, that all gave me an opportunity to show Cap learning lessons as he was growing up, and then dropping him in a situation where those lessons would need to be where we see them in use. And in issue 5, you'll really see, and I'll put a fine point on the 4 lessons that we've seen him learn in issues 1, 2, 3, and 4, and just how they have formed him, just how his Steve Rogers is a guy who's running away from the shadow of a father who was not a bad guy, but he was weak and he gave in to bad circumstances. And Steve wants to outrun that legacy more than anything. And at the same time, he's got this wonderful mother who is just intelligent, strong-willed, and not willing to compromise her ethics in the face of the Great Depression. And once I started to unearth this stuff, I started to understand Steve Rogers in a way that I hadn't before. And so, you know, the gamble is, are you gonna throw this character into a wild Jack Kirby science fiction world,
right?
Which I felt vindicated in, because Jack had done, you know, not quite this, but so many crazy things with Zola that this felt like a natural sequel to Jack's Zola stuff.
I gotcha.
But at the same time, I think that it offered me, at least in the setting, a slow build. And I know, you know, knowing where it goes, I think that slow build will pay off nicely.
Very cool. And I might be walking through the spoiler minefield, but you can't help but notice that Cap is in space, Iron Man is in space, the Guardians of the Galaxy are starting to gear up. And wonder when the convergence might happen. I don't know if that's part of the plan, or we might have to see, I guess.
I think that the sci-fi zeitgeist has finally come full circle, and I can feel vindicated in that because I was doing it first.
Boy. No, I like it. And, you know, I also like the idea of Dimension Z. It not only dovetails with, like you said, what Kirby did with Zola, but I also think back to that Captain America Bicentennial Adventure special edition. And I remember buying that on the stands, frankly. And, you know, just the idea of Cap just kind of – Cap works well in sci-fi, I think. I don't have a problem with that. And he, at the end of the day, he is this warrior, and why wouldn't he face the same kind of basic obstacles that he would face – in World War II or on the streets of New York or anywhere else in the world that you might dump him. You know, at the end of the day, he's a pure warrior. Taking care of Ian is an interesting angle too. And, you know, especially when Ian calls him Papa and everything, I always think that's kind of, you know, you never think of, even though Cap obviously mentored Bucky and Rick Jones and then Jack Monroe, that was always more of a younger brother. It is interesting seeing him in this father role, and certainly a contrast to his own father.
Sure, and of course that's going to be something that those are going to be nerves that I play with later on, is Steve recognizing, you know, in a lot of ways that you know, this is his number. This is the largest opportunity he's ever had to outrun his father's shadow. His father left him by passing away. His father left him in a dangerous, precarious situation in a dangerous environment. And he's not going to do the same. He's not going to fail that way. But, of course, you know, Zola and the forces and of this dimension are going to – they're going to put that to quite the test. So it does – it is sort of the intention is that all the history of Steve growing up plays a role in how he's now raising Ian and in this other dimension. So hopefully by the end of it, we'll have a very new status quo for Steve and a whole new supporting cast. And we'll also hopefully know the guy better and be a little more empathetic.
Is this the first long arc that you've spent with Romita? I know that you, Johnny, and Klaus did that Punisher list, which led to Frankencastle, of course. But is this the first time that you've worked on him in a multi-issue way?
Yeah, it is. And you know, it's a real privilege. You know, seeing the stuff come in is always incredibly exciting. I think that, you know, I think issue 5 is the first time we've like perfectly gelled our working method. I've been writing fairly tight scripts for most of the guys I've come up with, and for John, I've pulled that back issue by issue. So that he has more room to do his thing and tell the story how he sees it, and I think it's yielding nice results.
Very cool, man. No, I'm looking forward to talking to him as well. And like I told you guys when that press conference that you did for Marvel, I really – you could hear the excitement in both of your voices, and I think it's honestly coming through in the story. I like it. In the same way that I like Frankencastle, and I always appreciate that about some of your choices for your individual hero books. It really seems like you kind of do want to take these guys in places that they haven't been before. What's the response been? I don't know how much audience feedback you've heard right now on this first arc.
The response has been great. The stuff that the letters that have come in, we've had a ton of mail. I've had a lot of people. There's a guy recently contacted me who suffers from some kind of chronic migraines that can last for up to a month, and he was talking about how much it meant to him when Cap looked at that bullet. Cap opens up that present that Sharon gave him in issue one, and it's a bullet with Diligence engraved on it. and he was saying, like, you know, how, like, emotionally connected he felt to that moment, because he himself has to endure these long trials of such agony and pain. And, you know, that's the kind of thing where when you connect with people on that kind of a level, and when you get the metaphor of it all in the internal, in the struggle that he's going through, it's gratifying that somebody can find identification in something like that. You know, I've made the mistake of stumbling online, and it's like, it's the same as anything else I ever do. It's either like vitriol, or it's love, and that's okay. I'm, you know, that's what I'm sort of shooting for.
All right. I understand. No, I can appreciate that. And I did think that obviously this choice is kind of a polarizing choice, you know, and again, certainly coming off of Ed's amazing run, but at the end of the day, if you really look at it just from a genre standpoint, it's very meat and potatoes Captain America, which is great.
Sure.
And it was fun.
Sure.
But we got several years of that, and it is time for something different. And like I said, I mean, that's, to me, it's the strength of the character, much in the same way, and another polarizing arc across the street when they were doing New Krypton with Superman. And had Superman immersed in the Kryptonian society, taking away his uniform. And it's like when you're surrounded by a bunch of others, how super is this Superman? What makes him super when you take away the differences that make him unique and put him in a society where he's surrounded by, you know, people like him? And again, a lot of people hated that arc. I think it's a great opportunity to show the metal of the man, much like what you're doing with Cap.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great arc, and it's a great high concept, you know. Like it's a great situation to put him in and unearth the character. I think that the mistake a lot of us can make is, you know, for one, I recognize, like, I'm telling a 10-issue story with Castaway in Dimension Z.
Okay.
And we've seen 3 issues so far, and the choices that I've made are all quite methodical, and I know, you know, I don't waste scenes. If there's a scene, it pays out later, and I try to make sure that I cut out anything that is not mandatory to the story. And sometimes you can cut too far, even to the detriment of the story. You can trim it a little bit too much, but as a reader, I'd prefer something very concise that gets me moving. I like velocity, and so
that's all about Cap, man. It's that kind of kinetic energy that is Captain America. That's what Kirby brought to the book and everything. And I think it's there in this story with yours and Johnny's storytelling. Absolutely.
Well, yeah. What I was getting at is I think that the danger is to look at reviews or to look online, and I'm pretty good about cutting this out for the most part, and listening too closely, because you're dealing with the trouble with comic book reviews is that it's akin to somebody going in and reviewing the first 15 minutes of a movie.
Yep.
And it's people who might not necessarily understand structure. So it's not like, you know, they would even be gauging the screenplay based on, well, by issue, you know, by minute 17, they had set up the inciting incident or they hit all these landmarks they're supposed to hit. Instead, it would be just, I saw 15 minutes of a movie and here's why I like it and why I don't.
Yep.
And I've been long ago when I was first doing this and coming up, I made the mistake of reading some reviews and altering what I was doing based on them. Fear, in a fearful reaction. And it was the worst thing I've done. It derailed the story and it really hurt the book. And it's not something that I do anymore, obviously. But speaking to your question about, you know, the reactions, be they positive or negative, I think it's better to just brush them off, to put your head, dump your heart into the story and just do the best you can in staying pure to your intention.
Understood, man. I got to tell you, in issue two, there was a great letter to the editor and this kid, Jacob Collins, who's a big Captain America fan. I got to tell you, man, that was a great letter and a nice tribute to the kid.
Yeah.
And it made me smile and cry at the same time. It really did. This kid's a brave kid.
Yeah, it really broke my heart when that letter came in. I mean, it was great that we got to, you know, give him a shout out. But, you know, man, what can you say? It's heartbreaking.
Yeah. I'm telling you, man. Well, and onto brighter things. I like the energy of the story, and I like this kind of science fiction role for Zola, as opposed to just the mad scientist and everything. Have we seen Dimension Z before? Is this a new concept from you?
The big reveal is that Dimension Z is in a contact lens that the Beyonder has in his office.
Excellent. We're one Bauchan alum wipe away from destroying Dimension Z.
That's right. That's right. No, it's an all-new dimension, the purpose of which will be revealed. It's a place where Zola is free to experiment and to build an army and to do all of the mischievous, awful things that Zola was wont to do. But more than anything, it's an entire world for him to experiment with, and that's what the guy's all about. You know, the biofanatic. He's just a sociopath who sees life as clay, and he wants to jimmy it up. And so this is a place he can create new life and dump it into this environment and see what happens. And unfortunately for Captain America, he has to deal with it.
That's outstanding, man. No, and a great last image in issue three to whet our appetite for issue four. I don't know if issue four comes out this Wednesday or not. I don't know.
I think it's the Wednesday after. I think it's a week away.
Okay. All right. Good deal. Because, yeah, this episode then will come out before issue four. So if you haven't caught up, by all means, there's three out there and the fourth coming the next Wednesday. So catch up on Cap. And the other cool thing, I think, leading into Uncanny Avengers is you get to tell this kind of, you know, rough and tumble kind of Cap out of his element. And then you've got this very pristine Cap that's very true to form in Uncanny Avengers right now. And that's been a lot of fun and an interesting ride and a different perspective on the Red Skull as well.
Yeah, I mean, that was a tricky one. We had at the retreat, it was Jeff Loeb's idea, almost a challenge to use the Red Skull. And it was one that I gladly took. But once I got into the story, I realized I've got Thor and Scarlet Witch and Rogue and Havoc and Wolverine and Cap and, I mean, you put those guys in, you know, to roll my D and roll my 20-sided die for a second. You put those guys up against almost anybody, and they're going to kick a lot of ass. And the problem I had with the Red Skull was I loved the idea of writing this unapologetic, evil, vile, stinky monster, terrible. Like, there's no gray area with him. He's evil. He's evil, evil, evil. But at the same time, every storyline I came up with, and I must have gone through like 15, it was Red Skull goes and gets the ultimate nullifier. Red Skull gets all the infinity gems. Red Skull gets 15 cosmic cubes and inhales them, you know, crushes them and snorts them off of a stripper's ass. Red Skull, and it was just like this evil guy goes out, because he's just a dude. And then I realized, like, well, that's the problem, you know, like, what can I give Red Skull that makes him a match? And that was around the time that Xavier was being killed. And, you know, obviously I was privy to this much sooner. It was around the time that decision had been made. So I got on the horn with Tom and I said, I need to do the Xavier funeral to reestablish it in my story. And I need Xavier's body for my story.
It's like Weekend at Bernie's, basically.
Right, right. And yeah, and it kind of is, you know. But, you know, and I, you know, I pitched him and I told him, look, I want Red Skull to take Xavier's brain and cut out the important components and bio weld it to his own brain inside that helmet. And I got it approved. I think that it was everybody said yes, that does make Red Skull, you know, evil and powerful. So.
Well, and also just this idea, because, you know, as soon as Bendis killed Xavier, everybody's rolling their eyes, all the jaded fans, when's he coming back? And the great thing is that you are just kind of draping his corpse throughout your story, man. And, you know, just the decomposing body on the slab and, you know, when Rogue and Scarlet Witch are having the conversation and the whole schmear, man. I love it because it's just like, yeah, by the way, he's still dead. And yeah. And this is what's happening with his brain while he's dead.
Yeah. Well, what was important for me more than anything was that once I picked up Xavier for the book and he was a cast member, I felt a real responsibility to spend some time and to write a proper eulogy for him. You know, Wolverine's arc is very hopeless. I wanted to
talk about that. Go ahead, Rick.
He's, you know, he failed Chuck, and that to me hits me in my Claremontian fanboy heart. You know, and so it was something that was important to me that the series be scattered and strange at the first, and that we not have a team that's together, but instead have more chaos and more fighting and a complete lack of unity, and to spend some time to really establish how the death of Charles Xavier affects these people. Before you then reveal that, hey, by the way, the most vile scumbag in the Marvel Universe now has his powers.
I like it. I want to talk about that eulogy because I really felt much like when Loeb had to write the Cap eulogy. I really thought this was a great speech. And in fact, I'm really glad that I used the AR app and heard whoever they got to read.
Yeah,
the eulogy. But man, I'll tell you, heartfelt and no, really good stuff, man. That's a great eulogy. Jesus, man, you know, God forbid, knock on wood. When I go, I'd like somebody like you writing my eulogy. I thought that I you know, like I said, God forbid. But when no, honestly, man, it really was. It was very heartfelt. It was really sincere, and I really felt like you really heard James talking about his pal Chuck, and it really felt right.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, John. It's the kind of thing that when you there was a point at 3 a.m. one night when I had rewritten that like the 20th time, when I was sitting there and it really hit me, you know, like in terms of nerd privileges, this is Wolverine giving the eulogy for Charles Xavier. And I really wanted to try and give it as much heart and as much emotion as I could. And the fact that Wolverine feels like he failed him on such a level, it plays a role in the story as well, obviously, and that was the setting up Wolverine's arc that we have him traveling on. But yeah, thank you. I'm glad to hear that it worked for you.
Well, and it's another thing too that when I think the jaded fans examine comic book deaths and roll their eyes and, you know, are already counting the hours and days when these characters are resurrected, they miss these really important character moments. And I know I talked about this with Hickman when he killed Johnny Storm, and you had that really powerful post-issue of Fantastic Four and how everybody was dealing with it. And that's, honestly, man, this is the kind of stuff that, these are big moments. And, you know, like I said, jaded fans might, you know, just kind of rifle through and not take a moment and really appreciate it like a good soap opera and enjoy, you know what I'm saying, but enjoy this character moment of how these people deal with the fact that, you know, this important ally is no longer with them, and, you know, the hole in their hearts and the hole in their abilities or inabilities to go on.
Absolutely. And in terms of my book, it really establishes the reason they exist. And Charles is the example that Charles's lessons and my cast's inability to learn them will be dire consequences in the first 18 issues. They're not just going to change either, but Charles is, you know, he's the standard that they're all trying to live up to in their own ways and their own interpretations. And so when you see how this comes together, and you know, the big theme for my first year and a half is unity. And, you know, I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying not to give anything away. But the greater metaphor is that, you know, like the left and the right in our country, if we can't all come together and find some common ground and work together peacefully and cohabitate and come to solutions, we're all going to die, you know? And I'm trying to really sink into that idea with the Uncanny Avengers. It's not going to be an easy trip. You know, these two things have, you know, this chocolate and peanut butter have never mixed this way quite like this for a reason. And I think Wasp in issue 5, you know, puts a nice, a nice nail on the head of things when she says, I don't know much. I don't know what we can expect from this. We're through the looking glass here, but knowing the X-Men, expect drama.
Well, I also like that moment between Cap and Wolverine when Cap's talking about the mutant community, and Wolverine's like, "You don't get it. There is no community. It really is, you know, at this point, you know, a bunch of disparate souls kind of trying to figure out their way." I thought that was a really cool moment. And also just the whole idea of Havoc being this field leader and the role that I think Steve is trying to put him in. And again, my own X-Men inexperience.
Yeah.
You know, maybe this is a recurring theme for Alex Summers to be measured against Scott in this way.
Yeah.
But it's cool that Cap's giving him this opportunity.
Yeah, and Havoc is the only other X-Man who's led in the same capacity in a large public team, and that was during the Peter David X-Factor. And during that run, Alex was in charge of a government team of mutants, and he was somebody that passed muster, you know, and he was given the okay, and he ran the team. And so he's done this before, and he's a logical choice, and he's got a very different opinion than Scott in terms of being called a mutant. To Alex Summers, the way I'm writing him, being called a mutant is the M word to him. He's not a mutant. His name is Alex, and you don't need to refer to him as anything other than Alex. And he doesn't see it as like a cult that everybody needs to either join or be on the outskirts of. He sees his brother's methodology as segregation and a choice that his brother has made to further segregate the population and to do harm in Alex's mind. So there is these are polar opposites in terms of how they see the world and how they move forward. And I think in Cap's eyes, he saw an Alex and knew that this was the guy to do it. Now, is it going to work out perfectly? No, probably not. And you know, and Cap's going to have a lot to do with that as well. How long is Cap going to be able to take orders? When the shit goes down, that's when the real test comes. You know, is this a figurehead, Alex Summers, or is this the guy you're taking marching orders from?
Oh, I see. I thought it was more of as a field commander. I didn't realize that at the end of the day, Cap himself is putting himself under Alex's leadership.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, he's running the Unity branch. You know, and they'll be based out of the mansion, and they'll be a very public Avengers team dealing with you know, all manner of threats, but trying to promote, you know, equality.
Interesting. Well, tell me about Honest John, the living propaganda. Is this an existing character? I've never seen him before this arc. I love him. I think that's a great concept.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, no, he's somebody I made up. All of the S-Men are characters I made up, and I have big plans for him. The unfortunate reality of coming out of the gates with only 4 issues to set all this up is that a lot of those characters don't get the moments that I had planned. You know, a lot of that had to get trimmed down. But the S-Men, I've written pages and pages of notes on, and they'll all be back. Honest John, the Living Propaganda, all of their names come out of various folklore and fairy tales and mythology from different cultures across the globe. And unfortunately, at this, but I'm remiss to admit that I can't recall. I think Honest John might have been Germanic. I don't remember, but I believe that it is. I believe that he was. in some long forgotten fairy tale folklore. I just was just trying to work up something like, what does somebody like the Red Skull need more than ever? You know, well, he needs propaganda. Well, this guy's power should be that his propaganda is some syrupy sweet business that comes out of his mouth and sells you what he wants to sell you. And I like that as it's vague enough to sort of, you know, you can play with it and have some fun, but at the same time, it's very clear that this guy is emitting influence. And and then when you mix Red Skull with that at the same time, double whammy, they were able to take Thor over.
yeah. Great scene.
I thought Thor needed, you know, like if you've got two telepaths, and I don't know if Honest John's a telepath. I don't even know what you would define that power as, but both of those guys giving Thor the double whammy seemed like I earned his being taken over. But cool, yeah, I'm glad you like it. I think that when people get to see all those characters and I get to develop them a little bit more, there's a lot of fun stuff coming up.
Well, and you know, I not to besmirch the God of Thunder, but you can't help but think of the Ring of the Nibelung and all those great Germanic operas and putting together the Red Skull and the way that the Nazis really did kind of embrace the Norse mythology,
yeah,
in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And that really there is this undercurrent, as evil as the Red Skull is, that he can speak Thor's language to a degree, and certainly John can tap into that as well. And that's why it really was like, oh, this is great, man. Now the gods are being seduced by the humans. Now that's kind of an interesting moment. So, yeah, I liked it. I thought that was very cool.
Yeah, I could have written two entire issues of just the Red Skull getting into Thor's mind and throwing him against the rest of the team. And unfortunately, I've got 80 pages to set up the entire, you know, first story here. But,
sure.
There's a lot of fun stuff with that coming up. And obviously, Thor's not, until issue 4 is out, I shouldn't talk about it.
Okay, fair enough. No, very, very interesting ideas here, man. I really like it. I think it's cool, and that's the great thing is, as many Avengers books as there currently are out there, they all have their own voice, they all have their own purpose, and honestly, I'm enjoying all four of them. I think John's books are great. Kelly Sue's doing a great job with Avengers Assembled, and I think you're kicking ass with Uncanny. So, am I missing an Avengers book, a team book?
You got Hopeless on Avengers Assemble, Avengers Academy.
That's true.
You got Kieran Gillen on Young Avengers.
Well, that's true too. I you know, and I consider them different teams.
Yeah, they're sort of the X-Force, X-Factor, aren't they? Yeah, they're not quite, yeah, X-Men. But I'm glad to hear you're enjoying it. You know, I expected if you didn't enjoy it, you would get on here and tell me how much you hated it.
Exactly. You suck. What is wrong with you?
I wanted to ask you on my show to tell you something. You sir are a charlatan and a fraudster. The reaction and the numbers and everything have just been insane. You know, it's just you know, I'm an indie comic kid. You know, I came up.
Yes.
I've been doing this since 1997, and
attaboy.
I just can't stop, and it's sort of surreal to get to the point where you see that, you know, after digital and all the other numbers and newsstand and everything comes in, that, you know, you just sold 350,000 copies of a comic book.
Congrats, man. I saw those numbers. I saw those diamond numbers for 2012. And yes, Uncanny was right there in the top three, right? I mean, right there with Walking Dead, and I forget who else was right there with you.
I think it was I think Walking Dead was one, Uncanny Avengers was two, and Spider-Man was three. I think
that's right. Spider-Man 700. Absolutely,
yeah.
Man.
So, and definitely in good company, and the
here.
Yeah, it's crazy. But, you know, I also recognize that when I let myself think about the numbers or become involved in that aspect of it, that I run the risk of letting it taint what I'm doing, or it could scare me. So I try and not think about that. You know, and in terms of this, I knew that launching Uncanny Avengers, I knew the safe bet was to have the team come together, get them in a Blackbird rocketing at a danger thing, have the Blackbird blow up, have them crash and fight the danger, Like, I knew that I should just kind of double up what I did on X-Force if I wanted to just get, you know, action right out of the gates and make everybody happy. But my gut really said that this needed to be a character piece for two issues before shit started blowing up. And I think that's the difficulty with the big book, is that my gut knows that the character building way is the right way. Show me why Rogue is angry at the Red Skull before they fight. Give me context and show me that she's emotionally crushed, and show me every character's point of view, and show me why they're here and what they're thinking and what their motives are before they fight the bad guy. And it's fortunately worked out, and people like the book. But, you know, I do think that when I think about the numbers, that's the thing that I risk, is that by, oh my God, 350,000 people, you can't start this with a character story. Blow shit up. Make people punch. don't put thought talking into their punching book. You got to back up and go, fuck all that noise. Do it your way. And that's what got you here. And just do it your way.
That's excellent, man. And I've told you this before. It's great to see that you are finding your way through the Marvel Universe, but still retaining your voice. And I'm glad, man. No, this is and the Cap book is another example of that. And this is how I felt when you and Tony were doing Frankencastle as well. Tell your story, man. And like you say, don't worry about getting judged on that first issue or that middle issue, which is ridiculous. You know, tell your story. And right now, I think the proof is there. I'm glad to see that. Now, as we said, the Fear Agent Omnibus is obviously enjoying some success. Are there creative, and I don't want you to, you know, spill your beans before they're ready, but are there creator-owned projects that you're considering as we move ahead in 2013?
Yeah, in 2013 I have two creator-owned books that I'm doing. Devolution with artist Paul Renaud, and we're doing that at Dynamite. And that was a book that Paul and I put together back in 2006, and he had done a Fear Agent story in one of the tales of, and he's a genius. He's just a terrific artist. And so I introduced him to Nick, and Nick wanted him to do a Red Sonja, and they invited me to write it. And so we did a Red Sonja issue together called Vacant Shell, a one-shot that I'm still incredibly proud of. And Paul is just – he just blew me away with what he's capable of. So we pitched a creator-owned book to Nick, and – just finally in the last few months have been able to start getting to work on it because our schedules finally aligned where we had a little space.
Okay.
And then my Last Days of American Crime and X-Force cohort, Mr. Greg Tocchini.
Yes, sir.
We have a creator-owned book called Low, and I haven't announced the publisher, nor have I announced any of the dates on that yet. But that is also something that we will be doing this year. And then beyond that, I've got another couple creator-owned books in the works. I think the rest of them will probably fall in 2014.
Okay.
And then, you know, I'm trying to be a mature adult and schedule a reasonable workload, which is hard because, you know, I've got so many opportunities now to do so many fun projects. But I just don't want to get to the point where one of them isn't my best work, because why bother, you know?
I hear you, man. I hear you. Well, I'm glad that you and Greg are working together again. I mean, Last Days of American Crime was just beautiful, and I really loved the story. There was some movie traction, I think, that was mentioned either last year or 2 years ago. Sam Rockwell interest. I don't know if that's progressed any further since that buzz.
There's a lot of stuff to be announced soon. It's okay. Like any of these things, it's a slow process. We've got a lot of the pieces in place. We've got the new draft of the screenplay is in, and it's amazing. We've got a director locked in, and we've got a couple of actors. So, you know, again, we've gone through, you know, three different teams on this thing so far, and various, you know, unlucky factors have derailed it. But it seems like it's on track. So, you know, fingers crossed for me.
How about Fear Agent?
Fear Agent has slowed down. Which is really a heartbreaking thing.
Yeah.
You know, in 2004, sci-fi was dead, and I was like, well, that's why we'll kick ass on sci-fi. So now everybody's doing sci-fi in their comics and the movies, and it would be nice if there were, you know, some some traction on the Fear Agent film, but right now it kind of fell off the tracks. So hopefully we'll put it back together. We've got a plan, so we'll give it a try. I still think that it would make a better television series than it would a film anyway. So that's what I'm going to try and focus on.
Interesting. I hope so. I hope that happens, man. Well, hey, you know, we've all been on the Powers roller coaster with Bendis for the last 10 years or so.
Right.
So I understand. And, you know, no, man, I wish you luck. I think, you know, that's it. And again, we used the phrase high concept before, Rick. That's always been a hallmark of your writing. And I appreciate that. It's those kinds of big ideas that keep comic books exciting and beyond the girl tied to the railroad tracks waiting for the hero to save her. And you always find different ideas in different ways to not only explore superheroes, but the other genres that you touch as well. So what can you tell us about Devolution?
Devolution is I was reading an article about a government program where they were trying to find a way to regress a part of the brain that was found to be larger in religious fanatics than in normal people. And that there were attempts and ostensibly by the CIA to develop a drug that would regress this portion of the brain that was more active and larger in religious fanatics. And this was going to be part of our solution in the Middle East. Now, whether that is fact or fiction, I make no claims. It was just an article I read, but I started getting ideas about, you know, the classic Vonnegut, like what happens when man tries to monkey with things with science, it has to go south. And I was making notes, and I thought about the fact that they were trying to regress this part of the brain, and I wrote down devolution. And from there, I came up with a story about a world where the government did, in fact, devise this chemical agent, and they used it in the Middle East during war. And what it actually did is it not only regressed and devolved that one part of the brain, but it eventually mutated and became airborne and began to reverse mutate and evolve all life on the planet. So chickens become velociraptors or strange versions of them because of the reverse mutations. Cactuses, cacti become, you know, skyscraper sized, you know, giant death plants full of, like, you know, huge man eating worms. And then it just lets me go, like, and then I want ants that shoot poison, you know, which is like, that's why I like doing comics. But the idea got me excited, and I then grounded it with Paul. We got on the horn, and we created a character, this character Raja, who is a Saudi Arabian woman who was a daughter of the man who was one of the scientists who worked on the devolution agent. And she knows from her father's journals that he had created a revolution agent in the laboratory in San Francisco, and that this revolution agent exists, but everything went south before he could actually, you know, dump it into the water supply and solve the problems. So she's been on a 13-year journey from Saudi Arabia to San Francisco to find her father's lab and to save the world. And when we open our story, she's run afoul of some of the Marines who were given the antidote to this, as was Raja, our character, because she was the daughter of somebody who had it.
Right.
There are very few people who were given the antidote, but a lot of them were obviously the Marines who were deploying the chemical agent in the war. So she runs afoul a band of Marines who are still sapien, we call them in devolution terms.
Gotcha.
And they have... we get to see how they've devolved and how their society has also devolved in contrast with the rest of the world. And then that leads to the adventure to try and make her way to find this revolution agent in San Francisco through a world now inhabited by 8 billion Neanderthals giant insects, crazy plants, you know, maybe a few dinosaurs. I don't want to go crazy with the dinosaurs because really they shouldn't be. But that's why I say they're not just evolving, they're reverse mutating, because then I can create creatures that don't exist and I don't have
to
scientifically. Sure. But yeah, that's the basic, that's the stage, that's the main character and the motive. And of course, the humans that she hooks up with are not all going to be super helpful. Some of them are pretty content with the world the way it is.
I like it. Boy, there you go. Once again, the twisted mind of Rick Remender. I like it. Hey, you know, and it's funny. I told you earlier that and it's on the podcast, and you're on after him. I just spoke to to Ralph Bashkin.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering, being an animator yourself and some of these high concepts, do you ever get the itch to DIY some animation and stuff? And I mean, I know you've got the skills, and I don't know what kind of software and things you've got at your own house to either entertain you or possibly, you know, create some springboards that you could shop around, or even just, you know, like Ralph is doing himself, just do it yourself.
Sure. My buddy and frequent collaborator, Lee Lowridge, who was one of the colorists on Fear Agent and Punisher, and he's currently working with Dean White on Cap, he lives down the street. And so we actually have cooked up an animation pitch and had planned on Kickstartering it as soon as our schedules, quote unquote, free up. But it's a very, very funny idea, which I miss comedy. Like writing Deadpool was so wonderful because I could be writing the most dire, serious situation, and when it was too much, I'd just throw Deadpool in and he would make a fart joke and, you know. but it would be it's an idea for a comedy. And, you know, what the hard reality is that, you know, I've got a 3-year-old and a 2-year-old and a wife and a house and, you know, I've got bills. We've all got bills. And
sure.
I am just keeping my head above water with the work I've got and the bills I've got. So, you know, all of those abilities to DIY it would have been great if I was in this spot and I was 25. And, you know, I did plenty of DIY when I had the opportunity before the family, but it's
you bet.
Very, very difficult now that I've got, you know, the mouths to feed and the family to care for, to be the same guy who spends a year making Blackheart Billy or Captain Dingleberry or Dolan Creature because, fuck it, I don't care if they like it, I do, you know?
I understand, man. Well, that's another thing. Yeah, you mentioned Blackheart Billy. I guess no time for gaming right now, Dr. Jones. Is that the case as well?
No time for gaming?
Yeah, I know Blackheart Billy, wasn't that your Western... what was your Western game that Fox was all pissed off at you?
Oh, it wasn't a Western. You're thinking of Bulletstorm.
I am thinking of Bulletstorm.
Yeah, Bulletstorm. The producers loved Fear Agent, so we just made, you know, they just made their version of that. But the gaming industry is still calling. You know, it's scheduling. And I have to make all these difficult, terrible, terrible decisions. Do I burn the candle at both ends and try and juggle my Marvel work and write another fun video game where they let me off the leash to go nuts like in, you know, Dead Space or Bulletstorm? Or do I, you know, focus on making the best comics I can and just take it easy and have time for my kids? And so I've had to turn some jobs down, and it's never very easy, you know, given the years of struggle, I these opportunities come. But Blackheart Billy was my skate punk comic that I did with Kieran Dwyer and Harper Jayton. And we started that back in about 98. And then 99, we did some issues with Slave Labor Graphics. And a couple years back, IDW put together a compilation of all 150 pages. But I think Image is going to do a 15-year anniversary Blackheart Billy hardcover. So we should be able to get that back in print this year.
Very cool. All right. And I think you mentioned that last time we spoke as well. So that's good. No, I'm glad to hear that. And forgive the mix-up.
No,
but
no, John, you should know everything I've ever done. And you
it's true.
It.
It's true. It's true. We haven't talked Sea of Red lately. You know, and the like. And Nightmare back in the day? Was it a nightmare?
Nightmare is the heartbreak of my life. I still think that was one of the best things that Kieran and I did. It still stands as a high watermark for me in terms of that era of my career. I was just so proud of that book. And Kieran just bled out on the pages. But for some reason, nobody's read it. We've only ever sold, I think 4,000 or 5,000 copies of the trade, and it's been, 8 years now.
Understood. Well, that's all right. Hey, every idea has its moments. So that's the great thing, Rick, and this is something we've discussed before about you, is that, as you've had to say goodbye to some of these concepts, you've got enough product out there that when the time is right, who's to say? And again, look at the attention that the Fear Agent omnibus has managed to get. And I think that will only help. And I don't know if beyond the omnibus, if there's plans to re-release the run, arc by arc as well. Obviously, it's available digitally.
Right. And I think that the larger format is wonderful. And I think that, one of the things that I'm considering doing is to take all the horror work I did and put it in one big hardcover collection. Because
that's cool.
I was looking back, I started doing horror comic books in 1999, before there was any sort of a love for the horror stuff when I did Doll and Creature. I was thinking if I did a giant hardcover like the Fear Agent one, but I could put Doll and Creature in there. I could put Nightmare in there. I could put Sea of Red in there. Francesca Francavilla and Seth Peck and I did a book called Sorrow.
Yes, I was about to ask you what the book was that you, Franco and Francesco and Seth did. Sorrow, absolutely. I remember that.
And then, there's Triple X Zombies, the thing that Tony Moore and Kieran and I did. And I was adding it up and I was like, I spent a lot of time doing horror books. And I kind of forgot that was what I really wanted to do. Like for a long, long time, I just wanted to do horror books. But there was I was never in the right place at the right time to strike lightning. It was like I started doing my Frankenstein mummy book, Doll and Creature, and then Niles hit it big with vampires, and I was like, they're gonna want Frankenstein soon. And then Kirk Kirkman and Tony hit it big with zombies, and I was like, they'll want pirate vampires then. And then Sea of Red. I did like 15 graphic novels of horror material that I think would make a nice hardcover collection at some point.
Very cool. No, I hope you do it, man. That's a great idea. Very good, man. Well, as always, I've bugged you enough for tonight, but I think lots to get excited about in the world of Marvel, and then you've got stuff coming up at, like you said, at Dynamite, and forgive me. Oh, you haven't announced the publisher yet with what you got going with Greg.
No, we still have a lot. Yeah, I've teased some images. You can go to rickremender.com and just scroll through. There's a bunch of Greg's beautiful concept art for the series, but we have not announced anything else.
Understood. Well, in the meantime, you can enjoy Uncanny Avengers and Captain America. And as always, man, continued success, and you're doing it right, dude. So it's a pleasure to read every month, and I continue to do so and look forward to what's coming up.
Cool. Thanks, John. It's great talking with you.
So there you go. Two of my favorites today on Word Balloon, Ralph Bakshi and Rick Remender. It was a pleasure talking to both. And more great stuff coming up for the month of February, I'm telling you. We're hitting all your favorites and giving you new people as well on Word Balloon. And it's all brought to you, as always, by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where just like Word Balloon, they represent the whole comic book world, past, present, and future. Great books out there at great prices off the standard retail price. You can get things like the X-Woman trade paperback, which includes Milo Manara and Chris Claremont. Sexy stuff, I'm telling you. 40% off this trade paperback, $14.99. How about Michael Kupperman's Tales to Thrizzle Volume 2? Always a smile, always great ideas for Michael Kupperman in those books. 30% off. It's just $17.49. You can get Ultimate Comics, Divided We Fall, United We Stand crossover, featuring the work of Brian Wood, Brian Bendis, Sam Humphries, a ton of artists. 50% off. It's just $19.99. You can get the Global Frequency trade paperback from Warren Ellis and various artists, including our pal Gene Ha. 50% off, $9.99. Star Wars Omnibus, the Infinite Story Arcs, kind of what-if versions of A New Hope,
Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. 42% off, $14.49. Don't forget, if your orders are $50 or more from InStockTrades.com, you get free shipping. You can also go to their website to find out how to get an additional 2% off. So the savings are waiting for you and a great variety of choices to make. They make it easy for you. All you have to do is go to their search engine, look up your favorite writer, look up your favorite artist, your favorite character. You're liable to find a deal waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. John Suntra saying thanks as always listening to Word Balloon today, and thanks as always to our pals, the League of Word Balloon listeners. We really couldn't do it without you. Thanks for keeping the lights on for us and making it fun and making it possible to go to the conventions, keep the equipment new, and doing the show that we want to do for you each week. More great shows coming up in the month of February. Stay with us. I think you're going to enjoy it as always. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2013.